Welcome back to the Deep Dive. This time, we're diving into the story of Israel's first king, Saul. We'll be using Dr. Robert Chisholm's lecture on 1 and 2 Samuel to understand how he was chosen, why Israel even wanted a king in the first place, and what this whole saga tells us about God's relationship with his people, even when they, shall we say, make interesting choices.
Interesting is one word for it. We often think about, kingship in ancient Israel as part of God's plan all along. But it's actually a pretty dramatic turn of events, even a bit messy if you look closely.
Messy is right. Where do we even start with this one?
Well, things actually kick off on a high note in 1 Samuel 7. After years of oppression by the Philistines, the Israelites finally repent and turn back to God. They win a major victory. And for a while, it seems like they're content with God leading them directly. But that's where things take a turn.
That's putting it mildly. Chapter 8 is where they basically tell Samuel, yeah, we want a king like all the other nations, please. Not exactly a vote of confidence for God's leadership.
No, not at all. God sees it as a straight-up rejection of his rule. But what's fascinating is that he still instructs Samuel to give them what they're asking for, even though he knows it won't end well.
It's interesting that tension between God honoring the people's free will, even when he knows it might lead them down a rough path. Kind of reminds me of that time I insisted on taking that shortcut through the woods and ended up knee-deep in mud. Anyway, what's the deal with the delay? Samuel tells everyone to go home, but doesn't actually appoint a king right away.
Yes, the pregnant pause.
Hmm.
Dr. Chisholm suggests this might be a form of intercession, like Samuel giving God a chance to reconsider. There's real tension there, that struggle between God's desire to bless his people and their stubborn insistence on doing things their own way.
It's almost like they're missing the point. God had been their king all along, providing for them and protecting them, but they wanted something more tangible, something that fit the mold of the other nations. It makes you wonder, were they really seeking security or were they chasing something else?
A great question, and one that resonates with us even today. How often do we find ourselves chasing after things that promise security or fulfillment, only to realize later that we were seeking in the wrong places?
Too often, if we're being honest. So let's talk about Saul, this asked-for king, who steps onto the scene in chapter 9. It all starts with a seemingly mundane story about lost donkeys, but even his name, Saul, meaning ask for, seems loaded with irony, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It's almost as if his name foreshadows the problem from the start. This isn't a king chosen by God based on divine initiative. He's a king chosen because the people demanded one, and that sets up a fascinating tension throughout the story.
It's interesting how this asked-for king becomes a symbol of Israel's rejection of God's direct leadership. They wanted a king like all the others, but maybe, just maybe, God had something different in mind.
Precisely. And that tension becomes even clearer when we look at the original Hebrew. God calls Saul a nagid, which translates more accurately as ruler rather than melech, the typical word for a king like those of the surrounding nations.
Okay, so what's the distinction there? Why use a different word?
Dr. Chisholm highlights this as a subtle but crucial point. Nagid suggests a more limited role, someone who governs under God's authority. It's almost like God is saying, fine, you want a king, you got it, but he's going to be my regent, not a carbon copy of those other guys.
It's a fascinating twist on the whole kingship idea. Israel wanted to be like everyone else, but God had a different vision, one that emphasized his continued sovereignty and a different kind of leadership.
And it's not just the title that's interesting. The verb used to describe Saul's role is atzar, which means to restrain or hold back. It suggests that his role might be less about leading the charge into battle and more about, well, keeping the people in check, maybe even protecting them from their own worst impulses.
That adds a whole new dimension to the idea of leadership, doesn't it? It's not just about conquest and power, but about guiding and restraining, even protecting people from themselves. Have you ever felt like maybe that's what God's doing in your own life, kind of nudging you away from that shortcut through the woods?
I think we've all been there at some point. And with Saul, we see this play out in a very tangible way. While he's wandering around looking for those donkeys, God is working behind the scenes, revealing his plan to Samuel.
Talk about divine intervention. It's like those seemingly random events that turn out to be anything but.
Exactly. And the irony is that Saul, focused on finding his father's donkeys and haggling over payment with Samuel, seems completely oblivious to the greater plan unfolding around him.
It kind of makes you wonder how often we miss those seemingly insignificant details that turn out to be pivotal moments in our own lives. I mean, who would have thought that a lost donkey would lead to the selection of Israel's first king?
That's That's the beauty of this story, isn't it? It's full of these little details that on the surface seem inconsequential. But when you look closer, they're packed with meaning and foreshadowing.
Like the young women mentioning how everyone waits for Samuel to bless the sacrifice before they eat. It seems like a throwaway line, but it ends up being a huge foreshadowing moment, right?
Huge. It hints at the importance of ritual and obedience, but also at the potential for things to go very wrong when those rituals are performed by the wrong person for the wrong reasons.
Which is exactly what happens later in chapter 13, when Saul takes matters into his own hands and offers the sacrifice himself. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's get back to Samuel and Saul.
Right. So Samuel has received his instructions from God. He knows that this seemingly ordinary young man is the one chosen to lead Israel. And to confirm this, he gives Saul not one, not two, but three signs.
Three signs. God really wanted to make sure Saul knew this wasn't some random coincidence, didn't he?
He did. First, Saul is told he'll meet people who will tell him the donkeys have been found. Then he'll encounter a group offering him bread, a symbol of hospitality and provision. And finally, he'll be overwhelmed by the Spirit of God and begin to prophesy.
It's interesting that even after all these signs, Saul still seems hesitant. You'd think that witnessing the Spirit of God at work would be enough to dispel any doubts, wouldn't you?
You would think so. But even after this incredible spiritual experience, Saul still doesn't fully embrace his calling. Instead of taking immediate action against the Philistines, as Samuel seems to imply, he heads to a high place to worship.
It seems like a pious act. But maybe he's just delaying the inevitable. It kind of reminds me of that time I got that promotion, but then spent the next week stressing about all the new responsibilities.
We all have our moments of avoidance, don't we? And Saul's hesitation here reveals a lot about his character. He's not a power-hungry tyrant eager to seize the throne. In fact, he seems almost reluctant, even afraid of what this calling might mean for his life.
And that reluctance only deepens when we get to the public selection ceremony. Samuel has summoned the people, reminded them of God's faithfulness, and then, when it's time for the big reveal, well, Saul is nowhere to be found, hiding among the baggage of all places.
It's a comical image, but it also highlights the inner conflict Saul is experiencing. He's been chosen by God, affirmed by signs and prophecy, and yet he's still wrestling with doubt and insecurity.
And even when they finally find him and he stands there, head and shoulders above the crowd, there's a sense of reluctance, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Samuel presents him to the people, declaring, "Do you see the man the Lord has chosen? There is no one like him among all the people." But the people's response is telling, "Long lives a king." They're excited about the idea of a king, about the potential for military might and national pride. But they seem less concerned with the fact that this king has been chosen by God.
That tension between God's choice and the people's expectations is really at the heart of the story, isn't it? They wanted a king like all the other nations. But God had given them something different, a king who was meant to represent his continued sovereignty and a different kind of leadership.
Exactly. And to drive that point home, Samuel takes the opportunity to lay out the ground rules for this new monarchy. He's basically giving them a crash course in Kingship 101, drawing on the guidelines outlined in Deuteronomy 17.
Kingship 101. I think I missed that class. What are the key points here?
Well, Samuel emphasizes that the king must be chosen by God, that he should not accumulate excessive wealth or power, and most importantly, that he should rule according to God's law, not according to his own desires or the whims of the people.
It's a far cry from the kings of other nations, who often ruled by force and sought to expand their own power and wealth. It makes you wonder if this different kind of king was really a blessing for Israel, or maybe a subtle form of judgment.
That's a question that will continue to unfold as we delve deeper into Saul's story. But one thing is clear. Even from the beginning, his reign is marked by a sense of uneasiness, a clash between God's design and the people's expectations.
And that uneasiness only intensifies when we get to the end of chapter 10. Just as Saul is stepping into his new role, he's faced with his first challenge. A group of, shall we say, less than enthusiastic citizens who openly question his ability to lead.
The sons of Belial, as they're called, a term used in the Bible to describe wicked or worthless individuals. They refuse to give Saul gifts, basically saying, "We don't think you're up to the job."
Ouch. Talk about starting your reign on a sour note.
Right. And the text doesn't give us a lot of details about their motives. Are they genuinely concerned about Saul's abilities, or are they just troublemakers looking to undermine his authority from the start? It's hard to say for sure.
What's even more interesting is Saul's reaction. Or rather, his lack of reaction. He chooses to remain silent, leaving us to wonder how he'll handle these early challenges. Is it a sign of wisdom and restraint? or there's something more troubling lurking beneath the surface?
That, my friend, is the million-dollar question, and it's a question we'll be exploring as we continue our deep dive into the fascinating and often turbulent reign of King Saul.
Saul's silence at the end of chapter 10, it's intriguing, almost like he's choosing to ignore those who doubt him, at least for now. But silence can be interpreted in many ways, can't it?
It certainly can. Some might see it as a sign of strength, a refusal to stoop to the level of his detractors. Others might interpret it as uncertainty, maybe even fear. Dr. Chisholm suggests that this silence reflects a deeper kind of internal struggle, a tension between Saul's inherent humility and the weight of the responsibility that's been placed upon him.
It's fascinating how one small detail, like choosing not to respond, can raise so many questions about a character's inner world. It kind of reminds me of that time I was given a leadership role at work and completely froze up when someone challenged my decision. I didn't say anything, but inside, I was a whirlwind of emotions.
We've all been there. Those moments when we're thrust into situations that test our courage and our capacity for leadership. And for Saul, that test comes in a very dramatic way with the Ammonite crisis in chapter 11.
Talk about a trial by fire. Nahash, the Ammonite king, issues this brutal ultimatum to the people of Jabesh-Gilead. Surrender, or every man in the city will have his right eye gouged out. It's a horrific image, and it really throws into stark relief the danger Israel faces.
Absolutely. And it's interesting to note that this crisis erupts just as Saul is beginning his reign. It's almost as if God is allowing the situation to unfold in order to reveal Saul's true character, to see how he'll respond under pressure.
It's like a giant cosmic test, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The people are terrified, crying out for help, and all eyes are on Saul, this new king who they're not even sure they want. Can he deliver them from this threat?
Well, we see a dramatic shift in Saul. Remember all that hesitancy he displayed before? It seems to vanish in an instant. When messengers arrive in Gibeah, Saul's hometown, and tell him about the Ammonites' threat, he doesn't hesitate. He takes a yoke of oxen, cuts them into pieces, and sends them throughout the tribes of Israel with a chilling message. Whoever does not come out with Saul and Samuel will have their oxen treated like this.
It's a powerful image. A bit gruesome, but effective. It's like something out of a movie. A warlord rallying his troops for battle. But it also shows a decisive side of Saul that we haven't seen before.
Exactly. Dr. Chisholm points out that this is the moment when Saul truly steps into the role of a military leader. He's not just a reluctant king anymore. He's a man of action, capable of inspiring and mobilizing his people.
And the people respond. They assemble a massive army, 330,000 strong, ready to fight for their freedom.
It's a remarkable display of unity, especially considering the doubts that were swirling around Saul just a chapter ago. It seems that in the face of a common enemy, the people are willing to put aside their reservations and rally behind their new king.
It's a classic example of how external threats can sometimes bring people together, even when they're divided internally. So tell me of the battle itself. How does it play out?
Well, Saul divides forces into three divisions and launches a surprise attack on the Ammonites, completely routing them. It's a decisive victory, one that solidifies Saul's position as a capable military leader.
Talk about a confidence boost. He's gone from hiding among the baggage to leading his army to victory. You'd think that would put those doubters in their place, wouldn't you?
You would. And to be fair, most of the people are ecstatic. They want to celebrate Saul's victory and even propose killing those who initially opposed him.
It's interesting how quickly public opinion can shift, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
One minute they're questioning his ability to lead, and the next they're ready to crown him a hero.
It's a reminder that human nature is often fickle and unpredictable. But what's really fascinating is Saul's response. Instead of taking revenge on his critics, he shows mercy. He declares, "No one will be put to death today, for today the Lord has rescued Israel."
That's a pretty big statement. It shows a level of maturity and restraint that we haven't seen before. He's acknowledging that the victory belongs to God, not to him. And he's choosing to forgive those who wronged him.
It's a powerful moment. And it reveals a glimpse of the kind of king Saul could be. He's not just a warrior. He's a man capable of compassion and forgiveness. He's starting to embody those qualities of a true leader. Someone who puts the good of his people above his own ego.
It's a glimmer of hope, a sign that maybe, just maybe, this asked-for king is starting to become the leader God intended him to be. But of course, this being the story of Saul, things don't stay rosy for long, do they?
Unfortunately, no. Despite this initial success, Saul's deeper struggles with obedience and understanding his role as God's appointed king are far from over. And those struggles come to a head in the very next chapter.
Chapter 13, the infamous incident with the burnt offering. This is where things really start to go downhill for Saul, isn't it?
It's a pivotal moment, a turning point that sets in motion a chain of events that will ultimately lead to Saul's downfall. The scene is set with the Philistines assembling a massive army, once again threatening Israel's security. The Israelites are terrified, hiding in caves and crevices, desperate for their king to deliver them.
And where's Saul? He's waiting for Samuel at Gilgal, as instructed. But Samuel is late, and the situation is becoming increasingly desperate. The pressure is mounting, and Saul's old insecurities begin to resurface.
Exactly. He's told to wait 7 days for Samuel to arrive and offer the sacrifice. But as the days pass and the Philistine army grows larger, Saul starts to panic. He sees his troops deserting, and he fears that if he doesn't act soon, all will be lost.
So he decides to take matters into his own hands.
Huh?
He offers the burnt offering himself, thinking that he can force God's hand, secure his favor, and rally his troops. It's a decision that will have catastrophic consequences.
It is. And what's tragic is that Saul's motives aren't entirely evil. He's not trying to usurp God's authority intentionally. He genuinely believes that he's acting in the best interests of his people.
It's almost more heartbreaking that way, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's not a villain twirling his mustache. He's a flawed leader trying to do what he thinks is right, but ultimately making a grave error in judgment.
Precisely. And the timing couldn't be worse. Just as Saul finishes offering the sacrifice, Samuel arrives. Talk about awkward.
I can only imagine the tension in that moment. Samuel, the prophet of God, arriving to find Saul, the chosen king, standing over a smoldering altar, having just usurped his role. What's Samuel's reaction?
He's furious. He confronts Saul, demanding to know what he's done. And Saul, instead of acknowledging his mistake, tries to justify his actions. He says that the people were scattering, the enemy was approaching, and Samuel was late. It's a classic case of trying to rationalize disobedience.
It's like when you try to explain to your parents why you stayed out past curfew, but they're not buying it. You know you messed up, but you still try to make excuses.
Exactly. And Samuel, like any good parent, sees right through Saul's attempts to justify his actions. He delivers a scathing rebuke, telling Saul that he has acted foolishly, that he has disobeyed God's clear command.
And the consequences are pretty severe, aren't they?
They are. Samuel declares that because of this act of disobedience, Saul's kingdom will not endure. God has already sought out another man to be king, someone after his own heart. It's a crushing blow for Saul.
It's a tragic fall from grace. He started out so strong, winning a decisive victory, showing mercy to his critics. But this one act of disobedience, this one moment of trying to control the situation, changes everything.
It does, and it raises a profound question. What does it really mean to be a leader chosen by God? Is it about outward actions, about military victories and political maneuvering? Or is it about something deeper, about surrendering to God's will even when it doesn't make sense, even when it feels like everything is falling apart?
It's a question that resonates with all of us, doesn't it? We all face those moments when we're tempted to take shortcuts, to try to force God's hand, to do things our own way. But Saul's story is a stark reminder that true obedience requires trust, humility, and a willingness to let go of control.
And it's a lesson that Saul, unfortunately, seems slow to learn. The prophecy hangs over him like a dark cloud, casting a shadow over the remainder of his reign.
So his reign is essentially over. The kingdom is going to be given to someone else. But the story doesn't end there, does it?
No, it doesn't. Saul continues to rule for a time, but the narrative takes on a darker tone. There's a sense of inevitability, a feeling that tragedy is looming on the horizon.
It's like watching a train wreck in slow motion. You know what's coming, but you can't look away. But even in his decline, there are still moments of brilliance and bravery, aren't there?
There are, and those moments only serve to highlight the tragedy of his downfall. He's a complex character, full of contradictions, capable of great courage and compassion one moment, consumed by fear and jealousy the next.
And that complexity is on full display in chapter 14 with the story of Jonathan and the Philistine outpost. Talk about a dramatic turn of events. Jonathan, Saul's son, takes this incredible risk, attacking a Philistine garrison with only his armor bearer at his side.
It's an audacious act of faith and courage. Remember those words Samuel spoke to Saul after his anointing? Do whatever your hand finds to do, for God is with you. It's as if Jonathan, unlike his father, has taken those words to heart, trusting in God's power, even in the face of overwhelming odds.
And God honors Jonathan's faith. He sends a panic among the Philistines, causing them to turn on each other in confusion. It's a stunning victory, one that demonstrates the power of faith and the unpredictability of God's intervention.
And it throws Saul's own failings into sharp relief. Here's his son acting with boldness and trust, achieving victory through faith. while Saul is trapped in a cycle of fear, doubt, and disobedience.
But even in this moment of triumph, Saul manages to make things complicated, doesn't he?
He does. First, he makes this rash vow, forbidding the Israelites from eating until the enemy is defeated. It seems like a pious act, but it ends up nearly costing Jonathan his life. It's a classic example of Saul's impulsiveness and his tendency to prioritize religious rituals over common sense and compassion.
Right. It's like he's trying to impose his own sense of order on the situation, to control things through religious observance, rather than simply trusting in God's provision and guidance.
And then, after the Philistines are routed, he tries to force the battle to continue into the night, which only leads to more chaos and bloodshed. It's as if he's trying to compensate for his earlier failings, pushing too hard, trying to prove himself. But in doing so, he only undermines his own authority and puts his people at risk.
It's a tragic pattern that seems to repeat itself throughout his reign. Moments of brilliance and courage, overshadowed by impulsiveness, pride, and a deep-seated insecurity that drives him to make bad decisions.
And that insecurity becomes even more pronounced as we move into the next phase of the story, the rise of David.
David, the shepherd boy, who would become Israel's greatest king. But before he can claim the throne, he has to navigate the treacherous terrain of Saul's jealousy and paranoia.
It's a classic story of how unchecked envy can poison the soul and lead to destructive behavior. Saul, once a symbol of hope, becomes consumed by his fear of being replaced, by his resentment of David's popularity and God's favor.
It's almost like a Greek tragedy, isn't it? This once promising king chosen by God, brought low by his own inner demons.
And as we'll see in the next part of our deep dive, Saul's descent into madness and despair will have far-reaching consequences. Not just for him, but for David, for Jonathan, and for the entire nation of Israel.
Saul's descent into madness and despair. It's a powerful reminder that leadership, it isn't just about outward strength or even military victories. It's about character, about humility, about the ability to trust in God's plan, even when it feels like everything is falling apart.
That's so true. And as we shift our focus to David, we see like a stark contrast in leadership styles. David, the shepherd boy, the giant slayer, he enters the narrative as this unlikely hero, a figure who embodies the qualities that Saul seems to be lacking.
Yeah, it's almost like a classic underdog story, isn't it? David, the youngest of Jesse's sons, overlooked by his own family. Chosen by God for a destiny that no one could have predicted. It's pretty amazing when you think about it.
It really is. And what's striking is that God doesn't choose David based on, you know, his physical appearance or his social standing. He chooses him based on the content of his character, on the state of his heart.
Yeah, that's a powerful message, isn't it? The true greatness isn't about outward appearances or worldly success. It's about what's going on inside, about our relationship with God and how that shapes our actions.
Absolutely. And those qualities of character are evident from David's earliest actions. Think about his encounter with Goliath, the Philistine giant who's been terrorizing the Israelite army.
The classic David and Goliath story. It's one of those biblical narratives that just sticks with you, even if you're not, you know, particularly religious.
Yeah.
What is it about that story that continues to resonate with people across cultures and generations?
I think it's that element of courage and faith in the face of overwhelming odds. David, this young shepherd, armed with nothing but a slingshot and his trust in God, volunteers to face a giant who's been striking fear into the hearts of seasoned warriors. I mean, come on.
And everyone else is like, are you crazy? This guy's a giant. You're going to get squashed like a bug.
But right.
David, he's got this unwavering belief that God will deliver him, just like he delivered him from lions and bears while he was protecting his sheep.
It's a beautiful illustration of how faith can empower us to overcome seemingly insurmountable challenges. David doesn't rely on his own strength or skill. He relies on God's power working through him.
And of course, we all know how the story ends. Spoiler alert, David wins. He takes down Goliath with a single stone. A victory that becomes this iconic symbol of faith, triumphing over fear. And the belief that God can do the impossible.
It's a turning point, not just in David's life, but in the entire narrative. This victory catapults him into the national spotlight, making him a hero, a symbol of hope for a nation weary of war and oppression.
But as we've seen time and time again in these stories, fame and success can be a double-edged sword. And for David, this newfound popularity comes at a steep price. It attracts the attention of Saul, whose jealousy and paranoia are already simmering beneath the surface.
Right. And it's not hard to understand why Saul might feel threatened. He's been king for a while now, and despite some initial victories, he's made some pretty big mistakes. He's starting to realize that his reign might not be as secure as he thought it was.
And then you have David, this young, charismatic warrior, beloved by the people, clearly favored by God. It's got to be tough for Saul to watch this guy's star rising while his own seems to be fading.
Dr. Chisholm suggests that this is where Saul's kind of deep-seated insecurities really take over. He becomes consumed by this fear of being replaced, of being seen as a failure. And that fear drives him to make some incredibly rash and destructive decisions.
It's like his worst impulses are taking control. Those shortcuts through the woods, they're becoming his go-to move. He's no longer listening to Samuel. He's not seeking God's guidance. He's letting his jealousy and paranoia dictate his actions.
And what's tragic is that he directs that anger and resentment towards David, who, at least initially, remains loyal to Saul. He recognizes Saul's authority as king, even when Saul is actively trying to kill him.
What a crazy situation, David, this hero, this man after God's own heart, having to live as a fugitive, constantly on the run, trying to avoid being murdered by the very king he's trying to serve.
It's a period of intense testing for David, a time when his character is truly refined in the crucible of adversity. He's forced to live by his wits, to rely on the loyalty of his friends and the protection of God.
But even in those dark moments, we see glimpses of David's true greatness. He has multiple opportunities to kill Saul, to take revenge for the wrongs that have been done to him, but he refuses to raise his hand against God's anointed king.
It's a remarkable display of restraint and integrity. He chooses obedience and loyalty over personal gain or vengeance. He understands that true leadership isn't about seizing power. It's about serving a higher purpose.
It's a powerful lesson, isn't it? That even in the face of injustice, even when we've been wronged, we're called to act with integrity and to trust that God will ultimately bring justice in his own time.
And that trust is ultimately rewarded. After years of turmoil and conflict, Saul's reign comes to a tragic end on the battlefield at Gilboa. And David, the shepherd boy, the giant slayer, the fugitive, he ascends to the throne, uniting the tribes of Israel, establishing Jerusalem as the capital, ushering in a golden age of peace and prosperity.
It's a remarkable fulfillment of God's promise, a testament to the idea that sometimes the most unlikely candidates are chosen to lead. It's a reminder that God sees things differently than we do. He's not impressed by outward appearances or worldly success. He's looking for those with hearts that are aligned with his will.
And David's story doesn't end there. Even as king, he faces his own share of challenges and temptations. He makes mistakes. He experiences loss and betrayal. But through it all, he continues to seek God's guidance. He learns and grows, becoming a more mature and compassionate leader.
It's a reminder that leadership is a journey, not a destination. It's a process of constant learning, refinement, and growth. And it's a journey that requires humility, wisdom, and a willingness to submit to God's authority.
The stories of Saul and David, they're like two sides of the same coin. They show us the potential pitfalls of leadership driven by fear, insecurity, and the desire for control. And they offer a powerful example of leadership grounded in faith, humility, and a deep trust in God's plan.
Well, it's amazing how these ancient texts continue to offer insights into the human condition, into the nature of leadership, and into the complex relationship between God and humanity. What a deep dive this has been.
I agree. It's been a fascinating journey through the lives of these two kings. And I hope that our listeners will take away from this the importance of character, the power of faith, and the enduring nature of God's love and mercy.
Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive. We'll be back soon with another fascinating exploration of history, culture, and ideas. Until then, keep seeking, keep learning, and keep diving deep.